This is Six Music.
BBC Radio Six Music Documentaries. Telling the stories in music that matter.
I'm Dave Grohl with the John Bonham Story.
From Kraftwerk to the Sex Pistols.
Everything that precedes it is rubbish. We only might know three chords, but we have one fabulous word, and that's anarchy.
Find out more at the Six Music website. Now, Six Music Documentaries present Race with the Devil, the Gene Vincent Story.
I'm Roger Daltrey, and this is Race with the Devil, the story of one of the great rock and rollers, Gene Vincent.
Well, let an evil lie. See, but I'll have run the devil on the judgment day. I say, I'm a little fire, I'm old man. I'm a little fire, I'm old man. I'm a little fire, I'm old man. Down the line. Oh yeah.
Guns, knives, drink, drugs, women, pain from a crippled leg, tragic accidents in motorbikes and cars, Gene Vincent's life contained all the elements of rock and roll legend. It seems he was often a difficult man to get to know, and once you did get to know him, he wasn't easy to be with. Mean, moody, dressed in black leather, he wasn't afraid of sorting people out with his fists, and not just men either. But how does that square with the polite, gentle, mildly spoken man who chatted amiably to interviewers, fans, musicians, barmen, in fact, anyone he met along the way on the endless tours that took up most of his short life? This is Gene talking to DJ Red Robinson.
Well, backstage at the Georgia Auditorium is the man that got here early. One of the very few acts that ever gets into Vancouver early. Gene Vincent, how are you?
Just fine, sir. How are you?
Very good. You're looking quite good. How was the ride up? Kind of a drag?
It was. It was raining all the way, you know.
It's the question we always ask. Did you have any trouble at the border?
Sure did. I stayed there about 2 hours.
2 hours, eh?
Yes, sir.
Hey, your record Dance to the Bop and The Other Side, I Got It on Capitol, is doing real fine in the Northwest here.
Well, thank you, sir.
Yeah, when did you record that?
Same time with A Lot of Loving. Do you mind if I call you Red?
Yeah, it'd be better. Look, I don't want to call you, sir.
When I was with him, Gene was a very polite, fun person.
Dickie Harrell, drummer with Gene's original band, The Blue Caps.
A lot of personality as far as on the stage talking with the fans.
Gene never took drugs that I know of except for the drugs that the doctor would give him.
One of Gene's clapper boys, Tommy Bubba Fassenda, dancer, hand clapper, and backing vocalist.
Now, he never drank when we were with him except sociably. Maybe a drink here and there. So we didn't see Gene ever take drugs and drink. And that's what got him. I mean, Gene never took street drugs like cocaine or heroin and none of that. But he did take pain for his leg. And you were not supposed to drink with those. But then he would start drinking, and that's how his problem came about.
A lot of the southern rock and roll stars, they are very down-to-earth people. They're not stuck up at all.
Producer and label boss, Rockin' Ronnie Wiser.
True to his heritage, Gene Vincent was a real southern gentleman and a very kind person. So, you know, he treated you just like anybody else. I mean, like you were one of his friends.
My love said to me, she said a true love you'll be.
From an album called Forever Gene Vincent, released in 1980, 9 years after his death, The Rose of Love was one of four unaccompanied tracks recorded by Rockin' Ronnie Wiser the month before Gene died. The contrast with his hard rocking numbers like Race with the Devil, Blue Gene Bop, Woman Love, and his biggest hit, Bebop-a-Lula, is obvious. And it's a contrast that will seem to highlight the almost schizoid personality of Gene Vincent. Gene the Gentleman and Gene the Devil. Robert Plant puts it rather well.
Gene Vincent was as embittered as some of his songs would come across, and as also, in other moods, as sweet as his songs would imply, you know?
And today, I must go for the wild, wild rivers flow.
This is biographer John Collis.
He was very awkward to work with, could be very moody, but at the same time, you find so many people who say he was great, he was very polite, and if you watch a film of him on tour, he's very much the sort of yes ma'am, no sir, typical American. So he could be a very humble, polite man, but obviously he was, you know, Jekyll and Hyde.
But I have to say, if sometimes us performers get a bit awkward and hot under the collar under the media spotlight, we do deserve some sympathy. I mean, in my career, how many times can I answer, don't you wish you had died before you got old? This is Gene with a rather abrasive BBC interviewer in October 1971, the month of his death.
Well, the road is rocky, but it won't be rocky long.
Now, I remember you 10 years ago playing with Jerry Lee Lewis at the Fairfields Hall, and a young gentleman with blonde peroxide hair called Heinz. Do you remember Heinz?
Right.
What happened? He was booed off the stage. He was terrible.
You say he was terrible. Now listen, anybody who gets up on stage and who's even on the bill in the first place is not terrible. And I stand to say to you that that's not true.
You mean that no performance can be bad? Surely that can't be true.
Well, to you it might be bad, to me it might be good.
Well, I'm just saying the majority of the
people
there.
Yes, but
that
who
night,
are you to judge anybody's music?
I have
who
paid,
do you think you are?
I have paid to get in.
Right, and you can also get your money on the way out.
No, once I'm in, I'm going to stay there for the duration of the performance, and if I think a man is bad, I think I'm entitled to hiss or boo if I want to, or clap if I think he's good.
But who is bad? Who are you to say what's bad or is good? You're no judge of music. You don't read it, you don't talk it, or you don't live it. I do. Now, politically, business-wise, husband-wise, I might be a no-good son of a gun. But there's one thing I can do. I know my music. Can't mess me up on it, baby.
Woman love, hey, 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 woman love. Hey, 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 woman love. Hey, 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 woman love. Hey, 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 hey. Well, I went to my doctor not so long ago, walking in the circle, I'm all alone. He looked at me and said, good Lord above, son, you need a vaccination over.
Woman Love, the B-side of Gene Vincent's first big hit single, Bebopalula, a song that launched his career way back in 1956. Gene had started writing songs the year before whilst confined to a naval hospital bed in Portsmouth, Virginia.
Blue moon, blue moon, blue moon, keep shining bright. Blue moon, keep on shining bright. You're gonna bring me back, come on, baby, tonight. Blue moon, keep shining bright.
Gene would no doubt have heard Elvis on the radio, and he did perform in Norfolk, Virginia, Gene's birthplace, in September 1955. Presley had his local hits the year before with numbers like That's All Right and Blue Moon of Kentucky. Gene would also have been listening to the big hits from black artists like Chuck Berry and Little Richard, Fats Domino.
You made me cry when you said goodbye. Ain't that a shame? My tears feel like rain.
In 1954, America officially had recovered financially from the war. It took obviously a bit more time over here because we suffered a bit more. In 1955, there was this explosion of black artists getting into the charts for the first time. Chuck Berry, Fats Domino, Little Richard. Gene Vincent was one of the first white artists to come in on the back of that and benefit from it. And it really was the discovery of the teenager, I think. There were no teenagers before that because they could only exist as an economic force. And suddenly there was this new section of the population with Spending Power, the teenager. And Chuck Berry was the first to realize that they could be written for and there was money to be made here. But Gene was very close behind in the next year, 1956, and developed the idea of a band, a small group, rather than a big band. Like Little Richard had a big band, Fats Domino had a big band. Gene had this unit which became the norm, classically, in the Beatles, bass drums and two guitars. Really, he and Buddy Holly were the pioneers of the classic rock lineup.
Chuck Berry was born in St. Louis, Missouri, home to a thriving music scene. Little Richard and Fats Domino were from the Deep South, and so was white rock and roller Jerry Lee Lewis. But Norfolk, Virginia was better known for its massive naval base than its musical heritage. Today it's home to rappers Timbaland and Missy Elliott. But how and why did Gene get noticed back in 1955? John Collis.
It was really the rise to prominence of Elvis Presley that led other record companies to look for their own Elvis. And Gene had been going into the local radio station and making a general nuisance of himself. And he was Capitol's Elvis, in a way. And, of course, the first record, Bebopalula, just took off.
Well, Bebopalula, she's my baby. Bebopalula, I don't mean my baby. Bebopalula, she's my baby. Bebopalula, I don't mean my baby. Bebopalula, she's my baby. My baby.
Bebopalula. A song written by Gene and fellow serviceman Donald Graves, the guy in the bed next to Gene in the Portsmouth Hospital. The song, though, is credited to Gene and Sheriff Tex Davis, who was one of the DJs at the local radio station, WCMS. This is Gene's sister, Tina Craddock.
It was both of them. They got together, the guy in the other bed. And Gene would come up with something and say, "Now I can't get the next word. I can't get the next word. What? And the guy would come up with the word. And then after everything happened, Sheriff Tex Davis got in touch with the guy and bought his rights to the song for $25.
How it came to be recorded and how Gene got his first big break is not totally straightforward, as is the case with nearly all of these tales. Tina again.
WCMS was having a promotion, and if you wrote a song and sent it in and they accepted it, then you got a record deal with Capitol Records. Mama went down to the hospital and told him, "Son, this is something you can do." And he said, "I don't know what to write about." And she picked a comic book up off the floor and she said, "Here, write about that." And it was Little Lulu. So he did Bebopalula.
This is Gene in conversation with Red Robinson.
Capitol was holding a big contest, and they had 250 entrants. And I was one of the last ones to send mine in. And out of the 250 entrants, there was 243 who were singing Elvis Presley songs. And the song I sent in was named Bebopalula.
In fact, Gene's first big break was as a regular performer on WCMS. And he got it by just turning up and singing. Sheriff Tex, or Bill Davis, then helped him cut a demo to send to Capitol A&R man Ken Nelson. The demo included Bebopalula, Race with the Devil, and I Sure Miss You.
You took away my lovely dream, but I need those dreams at all. You took away the kisses that I love.
Drummer Dickie Harrell, who was responsible for the Blue Cap name.
They had a talent show, and it was called Country Showtime, and they would let all these people get up there, and they would do their thing, and every week they had like a little prize or whatever, and if you won, you kept coming back and all that. And so Sheriff Davis come up there. He said, "We got a young man that's in the Navy." He come up on the elevator, and I'll never forget it. He had his leg in the cast. He had two crutches, and he had on a baby blue shirt and a pair of pants. Real nice, real nice, real humble and everything. So we got to talking, and he did one of Elvis' songs. And when he left, Bill said, what do you think? I said, well, we'll try him. I said, give everybody a chance. So that night, we went down there and set up, and he come over there, and Bill went out there and introduced him. He said, we got a local boy here from staying here at the hospital. So let's give a great big local welcome for Eugene Craddock. So he got out there and did one song, and they went crazy, man. I'm gonna tell you, because that was the thing in those days, you know, something different. And Gene was different. His style was different. His singing was different. And Bill Davis coming there one day, and he says, I think I'm gonna get with Ken Nelson, who was a good friend of Bill Davis at that time, a guy from Capitol Records. So they got together, and we went to the studio over there at WCMS, and we made this dub for Ken Nelson, and I think it was Bebopalula, and I don't remember what the other one was, but it was nothing like the record that we made. This thing had a steel guitar on it, and it was real slow. So we made it, sent it away, and we didn't hear nothing for, well, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks. So one night, Gene come out there, and he sang, man, they kept calling him back, and Bill walked out there, Sheriff. He said, just a little added note, he said, got a call today from Ken Nelson at Capitol Records, and he wants to record Gene. He says he feels like there's some potential there. Well, they went crazy when they heard that. So after it was all over, I kept bugging him. I says, what's the story, man? What's the story? He said, well, we're going to get a session together. And that's when we picked up on the Blue Cap. See, we had Willie Williams and Jack Neal and Cliff Gallup and myself.
The damaged leg Dickie mentioned is, of course, the reason why Gene was in the Portsmouth Naval Hospital. He had joined the service in February 1952, much to his mother's distress, as the Korean War was still raging at the time. Gene saw no action, and in fact managed to get a transfer to a ship that spent more time in port, so he could spend more time with the girls and his big new Triumph motorbike. In July 1955, though, there came the accident that was to blight his whole life and cause him unceasing pain. Tina Craddock.
There was a four-way stop. He stopped, and a car stopped. He started to go across. She hit him. And she got out of the car and begged him, please, don't call the police, sir. I have no insurance, you know, please don't. He didn't. And 10 years later, she sued him because he didn't report an accident. Everybody always wanted money from Gene. He gave her $10,000 and just paid her off. Somebody help me, yeah, yeah. Somebody help me, yeah, yeah. Somebody please, somebody please help me. I saw him in pain. I saw him, honey, I wish I did just die right now. This hurts so bad. And he was a young man.
For various reasons, Gene struggled with the pain in his leg, but never had it amputated.
Gene was taken to the Veterans Hospital, and they wanted to take the leg off because it was crushed. When Mother said no, they put it back the best they could, and from then on, it just went from bad to worse. He'd go into the hospital and tell them, take it off. And every single time, I mean, it was awful, that doctors would convince them they have this new medication that's going to cure this. He would go through all the process, and then at the end they'd say it didn't work. We're going to have to take the leg off. And by then, he didn't have the mindset anymore.
Blue Cap Tommy Fassenda.
He told me, Tommy, I wouldn't let him take my leg off because I'm not a fish or I'm not a crab. And once it's gone, it won't grow back. It's gone forever. And I will always be known as an invalid. But as long as I got it, if it's on a brace, if it's on a cast, I still feel whole. but his pain was really bad. And this is how Gene got hooked on alcohol and painkillers.
Of course, once you're taking anything to numb the senses on a regular basis, you're going to need more and more of it for it to work. This is orchestra leader Ray McVeigh, who played tenor sax with one of Gene's British backing bands, the Beat Boys.
Weep for me.
Sometime he would come out, well, he could hardly stand, you know. When you get into his room to say, hey, all right, cha-cha-cha, whatever it was, there's like a half bottle of sort of Jack Daniels sort of lying there, you know, and he was sort of be drinking that. It's powerful stuff, you know.
Why do your branches hang so low?
Weeping Willow, a song probably written by Gene and recorded at an EMI session in London, May 1960, with the Norrie Paramore Orchestra. When he was Shane Fenton and the Fentones, Alvin Stardust toured with Gene.
We were doing Sunday concerts, and he wasn't well. He was in a lot of pain, and he was definitely must have been on some painkillers, and he might have been taking blues or something to just keep himself going, really, because it was hard work travelling and doing gigs. But he was drinking a lot. And one night he went on, he was so wobbly, he fell off into the pit. I remember, I think it was Blackpool. Everyone was in the wings as Gene went on to see if he was going to be all right. But the tour manager was quite confident. He'd been with him all the time, except when the tour manager went to the loo in the hotel room, and Gene must have raided the bar, put these bottles of vodka in his crutch that he used to use to walk around with. And when he went on stage, we thought, he's absolutely legless. The tour manager said, no, he can't be. And then his crutch fell on the floor, and we heard this crash tinkle, and liquid was coming out the end of the thing. We took the rubber stuff off the bottom, found all these little miniature vodka bottles and things, stuffed up the crutch, so he was desperately drinking. I cried. It seriously was that sad.
One of Gene's daughters, Sherry, was only a baby when her father was living in Streatham with her mum, Marjorie, Gene's second wife. It's from her mother that she's heard tales of her somewhat wayward father.
When you examine the people that were in his life, how many of those were really looking out for him, the person? You know, they would actually feed him the bottles of scotch and stuff in order to be in his pocket or to be the groupie, or because, in fact, if you did care about him, you would have been doing the opposite. And, in fact, I know a lot of it has been said of Don Arden, what a difficult man and a violent man and stuff he was, but my mother has always spoken very positively of Don Arden and said that he was the one person that gave Gene the opportunity and put structure in his life. And for the very short time that he was married to my mother and lived in England, he lived a proper family life, although it was all rather short-lived because, again, you know, my father would take to the bottle and... There's a story of my mum cleaning up one day after, I think, a bit of a domestic, and found all kind of scotch bottles, like, behind the cooker and in drawers, all the things that you would expect of an alcoholic.
Crazy times we'll have for you and me, I promise. Crazy times we'll have for you and me, yeah, honey. Crazy times we'll have secretly.
Typically, the alcohol abuse led to violence. Eric Burden.
I remember when I went to a Gene Vincent show in the UK, and he had a backup band, one of Brian Epstein's project bands from Liverpool, and the drummer was a big guy. And by that time, he and Gene were in each other's faces, you know. And he walked by Gene Vincent's dressing room and just jumped up and kicked the door in of Gene's dressing room and then took off running. Gene had been sitting combing his hair, and he whipped out a Derringer, a small pistol, and he fell backwards over the chair and rolled onto his feet into a kind of a FBI stance and fired off a couple of rounds that lodged in the wall. When the smoke cleared, thank God nobody was injured, and it was all a big laugh, you know, but it could have been dangerous stuff.
Eric wasn't the only one to witness Gene's fascination with guns. This is one of the shadows, Chet Harris.
Oh, Gene was a very funny guy, actually. He pulled a gun on me once, you know. It was loaded, too. I was in the dressing room with Johnny Layton and me. We were sharing the dressing room, Gene, Johnny Layton and I. And we were combing our hair in the mirror or something, Johnny and I, and all I heard behind me was Harris. And I turned around, and there's Gene with a .45.
Ray McVeigh was never himself threatened, but was always aware of the contents of Gene's bag.
Yeah, he had a knife in here. And a gun, he had a gun and a knife. Seemed to be a very insecure man about his whereabouts and what he's going to be doing and who's looking over his shoulder.
Eric Burden's diagnosis of Gene's state of mind may seem a bit harsh, but I suppose he has a point.
I would say that he was suffering from constant psychosis, you know, due to huge amounts of alcohol. We all dabbled in black bombers and little blue pills up as I'm sure they were already available for Gene to get his hands on. And you mix that with fame, it can do really strange things to your head. And the press wanted anything to write about. Well, it hasn't changed, has it? I mean, it's still the same today. The more stoned you are, the more out of control you are, the more fights you get into, the more press you get.
Lay that pistol down, babe. Lay that pistol down. A pistol packing mama. Lay that pistol down.
Pistol packing mama. Another of the tracks Gene recorded at that EMI session in 1960, with Norrie Paramore as producer and Ray McVeigh on tenor and baritone sax.
We went in studio. Ken Nelson was there, Owen Bradley was there. And to be truthful with you, I don't think that they had ever heard Cliff play, because Cliff was not on the dub that we sent to Nelson. And, oh man, they loved it. So we got to doing this and doing that, and he did a little bit of Woman Love and all kind of stuff, and then they came up with Bebopalula, and then when he did Bebopalula, we did the Scream, see? And when we did the Scream, everybody just stopped dead. And Ken Nelson says, he said, hold it, what happened, boys? What'd y'all stop for? I don't think Cliff really liked that part about me screaming, because, you know, Cliff was one of the best guitars in the world. I mean, a lot of people been influenced by him. He was a good guy, but he was strictly music. That's why he was so good.
Ken Nelson then had to come up with a follow-up single and an album's worth of songs. But it's possible that that first album, Blue Jean Bop, was a bit rushed. The mix of material was bizarre. Rock and roll belters like Blue Jean Bop and Who Slapped John jostled with traditional numbers such as Hoagy Carmichael's Up a Lazy River and an even more extraordinary Peg of My Heart.
Peg of my heart, I love you, don't let us part. I love you, dear little girl, sweet little girl. Well, since I heard your lilting laughter, it's your Irish heart.
I think he had no intellectual control over his repertoire or over his recording. I think he was a very simple man and just did what he was told. So, for instance, he would record a song like Peg of My Heart, which is just a sentimental frippery, really. But someone would have come up with that at the session, and so he said, I'll do it.
The rock and rollers were playing straight-ahead rock and roll. You know, Chuck Berry was doing what he did, and Jerry Lee Lewis around that time. Elvis kind of mixed it up. He'd do some old ballads with the rock and roll, you know. But I think with Gene, first couple of albums, I think he had a great producer, Ken Nelson. And I think he encouraged Gene to really mix the music up on the record. You know, you get a real fast bop, and then they'd, you know, do something like Over the Rainbow or Now Is the Hour or so, you know, some Peg of My Heart, really, like a tune that was like 30 years old or something, you know. So it was a real nice mixture.
Guitarist Albert Lee is a little more taken with Ken Nelson's mix of the old and new in Gene's albums. He clearly admires Gene's version of Over the Rainbow, and so too does Manchester Vincent fan Mark E. Smith, lead singer with The Fall.
They like anything ever by Gene Vincent. I know I do. One of the few people I can say that about. I don't know. Got all sorts of LPs by him, you know. Party Time, and got his first LP, you know, that's good. And, I even like Somewhere Over the Rainbow by him. It's not the greatest song, is it? That's how good he was, I think. You can make crap like that sound good.
The dreams that you dare to dream really do come true.
I was at a party with my manager when I was on Atlantic Records as a solo act. And my manager introduced me to Judy Garland, and Judy and myself got talking, and then I asked her to dance. And while we were dancing, Judy said, "You know, my favorite version of Over the Rainbow." And I thought, sure, she was going to say herself. I said, "No, who?" She said, "Gene Vincent."
Tommy Fassenda. Tommy was one of the new set of blue caps recruited by Gene after several of the original members left to go back to their families. One was ace guitarist Cliff Gallup, who only played on 35 Gene Vincent tracks, but who impressed a future generation of guitar players, such as Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, and former Pretenders guitarist Adam Seymour.
He did Bebopalula, they went on tour. He didn't like being away from home. He was already married, and I think he was a little bit older than the rest of them too. And so he decided to jack it in fairly early on, which in these days and times when everybody wants to be famous and be in a band and they will not let go and they want to do is promote themselves, is absolutely unthinkable now to think that some amazing guitar player would then go like, well, you know what, I think I'll just stay at home with the missus and I'll do something else, rather than continually waving a flag. He's playing on, say, a track called Cruising, where he did this amazing, very technically adept, very fast part of soloing, which is kind of his trademark, but then he slips into this really angular right across the beat, really interesting notes, and then he's back into this other thing, and this is all within the space. I mean, his solos he had to fit into like 15 seconds or something, because the records only lasted a minute and a half, so he's allotted time with small. But he went into many places in those things. I think that's why for guitar players he stands out, because he did turn some interesting corners within such severe limitations, really, because they were doing 12-bar rockabilly blues stuff.
On foreign tours, Gene usually played with a pickup band. But on an Australian tour in 1957, the Blue Caps made their only trip abroad. The tour was a huge success and a good time for Gene, particularly as his single, Lot of Loving, had hit the charts after a long line of failures that had followed Bebopalula. Gene's new friend, Eddie Cochran, was also on the tour.
Ooh, well, I gotta get with a record machine. When it comes to rockin', she's the queen. We love to dance on a Saturday night. All alone where I can hold her tight, but she lives on the 20th floor of town. The elevator's broken down, so I walk one.
Eddie Cochran was to become an important figure in Gene's life, just as Gene was destined to become an important figure in Eddie's death. Few will deny they were close friends, perhaps because they seemed to complement each other. Eddie was open, warm and friendly. Gene was often remote, moody, withdrawn. Ray McVeigh.
He wasn't a talker. Eddie Cochran could chat to the public and tell a lot of yarns and all. He wasn't a chat man. He said, now we're going to do like, well, I'm going to do whatever it was. Now we're going to do this, we're going to do that. That would be his limitations on the chat, you know. He just wanted to go on with his act and sort of get off, you know.
The friendship between the two was set in vinyl when Eddie sang bass alongside Paul Peake and Tommy Fassenda on a session that was to become Gene's fourth album, a Gene Vincent record date. No one told Liberty Records, nor Eddie's manager, Jerry Capehart. Tommy Fassenda.
Eddie was an honorary blue cap. Eddie said, y'all need a bass voice on this song. I said, well, you know, Eddie, we don't have one. He said, I'll do it if you won't tell Liberty Records or Jerry Capehart. I said, good. Get it. It was the name of the song. Paul sang tenor, I sang lead, and Eddie sang bass.
Well, oh, well, oh, up, whip, whip, whip. Well, oh, well, oh, up, whip, whip, whip.
Well, oh, well, oh, up, whip, whip, whip. Well, oh, well, oh, up, whip, whip, whip.
In the early years of his success, Gene would often be drowned out by the screaming of young girls. But as time went on, all that changed. Bay McVeigh.
He was great lots of times. Lots of times I always felt a bit sad for him, you know, because he always seemed to have a few problems, you know, and all the girls in the theatre never screamed for him. They were screaming for Billy Fury. But all the guys in the audience, they all loved Gene Vincent. But the girls loved Billy Fury. He used to get upset about it.
It's a big fat Saturday night, and everybody's got a date but me.
In 1960, Gene and Eddie embarked on a lengthy tour of the UK, a tour arranged by legendary promoter Larry Parnes. The American duo was accompanied by an army of backing musicians and support acts such as Billy Fury, Joe Brown, Georgie Fame, and Vince Eager. At this point in their career, neither Gene nor Eddie were big stars in America, pushed aside by squeaky clean teen idols like Fabian or Bobby V. This is Tony Meehan, who, as one of the Shadows, toured the United States in 1960.
We went to America in a very diffident way. We wanted to show them that we could play and we were good, you know, we felt we were good and as good as them. But I think rock and roll had changed a great deal from the time of its innovation, which we sort of followed with the Jerry Lee Lewis's and the Gene Vincents. I mean, most of the people we met in 1960 had never heard of Gene Vincent or Eddie Cochran. Can you imagine that?
He did have a few hits in America, but America tends to forget very quickly. The other examples are Buddy Holly and Eddie Cochran, Gene's great friend. Over here, they were revered, and after their death, they were, if anything, more successful than when they were alive. In America, they just move on. So by the time he came over here in 1960, he was a fading pop star.
Biographer John Collis and former Shadow Tony Meehan. A play called Bebopalula was revived in Los Angeles. Written by Rex Weiner, it was originally produced in 1991 by Adam Ant, Doors drummer John Densmore, and Johnny Depp's wife Laurie. It explored the relationship between Cochran and Vincent during that tragic tour in which Eddie was supposed to have had a premonition of his impending death. Here's an extract performed especially for this program by Aaron Dupree as Gene and Chance Dean as Eddie.
Lay that pistol down, baby, lay that pistol down. Pistol back in mama, lay that pistol down.
Pretty good for a couple of washed up failures.
Now don't joke about it, man.
It was just a joke.
Well, I wasn't joking, okay?
Touchy.
Yeah, what's so funny about it, huh? We are failures, you and me, flopperoo.
For crying out loud,
you
Gene.
You brought it up.
Yeah, I'm real sorry I did, too.
When was the last time you had a top 10 hit?
Last year.
English top 10 don't count. I'm talking about top 10 back home.
Okay. Summertime blues.
I'd like to help you, son, but you're too young to vote. You know when that was?
August 1958.
2 years ago.
So what?
So my last hit was 1956. Man, I'm telling you, Eddie, time has passed us by. We're like the last desperados.
Now there are three steps to heaven.
It'll all be over soon. I hear thunder. Rain's gonna fall.
Man, it's always raining over here. If you thought it was all over, man, I mean, if you thought it was going to end tomorrow, how could you go on?
Well, now that's just it, ain't it?
Yeah, I guess.
Sure could use those pills.
You hear that?
Hear what?
Nothing.
Step through. You kiss and hold it tightly.
No one will ever know whether Eddie Cochran did have a premonition of his own death. But late on April the 16th, 1960, the Ford Consul he was travelling in with his girlfriend Sharon Sheely and Jean Vincent hit a lamppost on the A4 near Chippenham. Homesick, Eddie and Jean were going back to the States for a break, before rejoining the tour at the end of the month. Ray McVeigh remembers an unusual and rarely heard twist in an often told tale.
Usually I should jump in the car with the guys, you know, and I did jump in the car with the guys. But all of a sudden, Eddie Cochran had a problem because he wanted to take his amp back. He was going to leave it, but he decided to take it back, you know, because it was playing up. They wanted to take it back. So the driver says, okay, go and get the amp, man. So he came out with this, you've got to bear in mind, the amps were quite big. Not tiny things like now, you know, like big things. They came out, they're struggling out with this big amp. And this kind of driver said, oh, my God, you know. So it wasn't a problem. And I said, I'll just go along with the boys in the van. So I get out and he got his amp in, off they went. And the next thing is, when we were driving along with the van, coming up, it was outside Chippenham. And the roads in those days were so bad, you know. There's no lights on the roads in those days. Now you've got street lights and nothing like that in those days. And next thing is, we were driving on, we seen there was an ambulance there, and there was a police cars were there, and sort of, and we thought it was an accident, and then we realised it was the car. We were all cut up. You've got to bear in mind, we were all sort of youngsters, we didn't know what to do. I couldn't get the guys together, we were all drifting, and I went down to the hospital, and to see them, and I spoke to one of the nurses there, and the doctors, and the doctor says, Gene Vincent will probably be all right. He says, but the other guy, what's his name? Mr. Cochran. I said, yeah, Eddie Cochran. He says, he's pretty bad. And he says, and I mean pretty bad, you know. So from then onwards, I was ringing and trying to find out what was going on. And I heard someone sort of say, if he had lived, he would never be the same again, because he smashed his head all open at the back, and it's sort of just a mess, you know.
Tina Craddock recalls a strange event back home.
We heard when the hospital called and said that Gene was dead. Three times we were called saying that Gene was dead. And then later on that night, you can imagine Mom and Dad, they were just terribly upset. Gene called and said, you know, he was fine, he was out of it. Him and Eddie were sitting there having a cigarette. Gene didn't realize it. Eddie was dead. Because he thought the guy in the next bed was Eddie.
Well, I'm going home to see my baby. Yeah, I'm going home to see my girl.
Gene returned to the UK tour, but then flew back to the States after receiving a mysterious telegram saying that his daughter Melody, by partner Darlene Hicks, had died. It was not true. Did Gene send the telegram to get out of the Eddie Cochran tribute show that Larry Parnes had booked him on? We'll never know. But one thing is certain, Gene began to act even more erratically as he began to drink more. He was now based in the UK, managed by the infamous Don Arden, touring and recording with the backing band Sounds Incorporated. I'm going home from the 1961 recording dates at the Abbey Road Studios. There was to be only one final session for Capitol the following year. In fact, the 60s was generally not a good time for Gene or his music. He toured with various bands throughout Britain and Europe, but the Beatles and all of us lot like The Who, The Kinks and The Rolling Stones had pushed to one side what was now an old-fashioned kind of pop. He did make some recordings on Columbia, with John Peel's label Dandelion, and with Karma Sutra, but there were no more hits. His leg was deteriorating badly. In more and more pain, he drank endlessly, pulled knives, picked fights. His relationship with Darlene foundered, and his marriage to Margie was short-lived. Their daughter Sherry recalls her one and only meeting with her father, 10 days before his death.
Looking back over my life.
My mother told me we were going to see him that evening, so on my return from school, I got all dressed up in my party gear, and we got a taxi to Ealing Common. We were living in Chiswick at the time, so it wasn't far up the road.
Yes, I know. Make the same mistake again. Looking.
He asked me if I'd like to walk around the garden with him. So my father and I entered this garden of this hotel, and it was a rose garden. And he held my hand and we walked around, and he asked me about school and my friends and, you know, various things like that. And we just sort of did basic chit-chat. And then there was a bench in the garden, and we sat on this bench. And I sat on his lap, and that's when he said to me that he was sorry for not being the father that he should have been, and that he'd often thought about me, but it was all going to be different now, and he was going to keep in touch, and he was going to have me come over to America, and he'd be coming over to England a lot more. And we kind of almost like made a promise to each other to renew this relationship of father-daughter. And I suppose now on reflection, I wonder if perhaps he knew that he was near to death, and it was the, you know, words of a man who kind of was perhaps at the end of his life, and full of regret, really.
Caught you some strife, but you know. That I'll never make this same mistake again.
In 1969, the BBC made a documentary on Gene, following him around England on tour. The support band was the Wild Angels, and Mal Gray was the vocalist.
There's a lot of stuff on film that never got showed for various different reasons. Quite a political and quite a violent backstage tour. Gene was the one with getting the dirty end of the stick all the time. They showed Gene on stage a couple of times, and they showed his embarrassment at having no money and being robbed of sandwiches, even. There was one incident when the penny started to drop. We were all sitting around a table, including Henry Hemroyd, who was the tour manager, Arden's couple of heavyweights, and we all got up to go upstairs for one reason or another. It's all being filmed. And we're five steps away from the table, and I would always let Gene go in front of me because that's how I felt. And Henry turned round to Gene and said, "Oh, Gene, pick that bottle up, we'll take it upstairs." So then you've got a picture of Gene on a boat, on a ferry, walking four or five steps towards a table to grab a half-empty bottle of wine and carry it up the stairs, all being filmed. And the penny started to drop that these people were just setting the guy up left, right and centre for whatever reasons I was unaware of at the time.
Some of the last recordings Gene made before his death from a burst ulcer on the 12th of October 1971 were produced by Rockin' Ronnie Wiser. He had to track Gene down.
If you should ever change your mind.
I'm at Aaron's record shop, and the owner, Manny Aaron, I asked him, "Do you know what happened to this guy, Gene Vincent? I mean, do you have any record by Gene Vincent?" Nobody knows anything about him. So Manny, the owner, says, "Look, Gene Vincent lives right here in Hollywood." When I go home, I try telephone information for Gene Vincent, nothing. So I try Eugene Craddock. And sure enough, Eugene Craddock lived on Fuller Avenue, which was only four or five blocks from my house, from my apartment. You know, I say, "My God, I gotta meet him. You know, I gotta go see Gene." So I drive over there, and as I'm driving over there, there's a little red convertible car coming with a guy that looks kind of familiar. I see his greasy curly hair all over the place, the wind from the car. So he parks a car. I go out of mine and I say, "Gene, my name is Ronnie Wiser, Hollywood Rock and Roll Fan Club. Could I ask you a few questions?" And he's very friendly. He says, "Yeah, come on over, come on over." So we go upstairs to his place, and he starts offering me sandwiches, soda pop, Coca-Cola, cookies, you know, potato chips, whatnot, and asking me about what classes do I take at UCLA, blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking to myself, Jesus, I mean, here is this rock and roll legend, this incredible singer, Gene Vincent, and this guy's asking me questions. Yeah, I mean, this is like the Twilight Zone. He was releasing records on Kama Sutra and different labels, which were quite good, but something was still missing. The original soulful Capitol sound, the true thing. It's just like Little Richard on Specialty. You cannot touch that. He went to VJ Records later, and it was not the same thing. So I asked Gene if he were willing to record a few songs for his fans. And he said, okay. He comes over, and it's a small bedroom in Hollywood. My brother and myself shared it. And there is a small desk in front of a window. So there's $145 or $48 Akai tape recorder and a $10 microphone on the desk. And there is Gene with his acoustic guitar. He chose the Rose of Love, the Little Richard song, Hey, 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 Sam Cooke, Bring It On Home to Me, and Party Doll by Buddy Knox.
Well, everybody's gotta have a party doll to be with him when he's a feeling wild, to be ever on the true and fair, to run her fingers through his hair.
Some might say that Gene Vincent's career was over in 1960 when he stepped into that Ford Consul. Certainly, in his home country, he was a largely forgotten man, even if us Brits kept him going for another 10 years. But Gene's legacy is greater than that. For a start, he was one of the first on the scene. John Densmore, drummer with The Doors.
One of the original 50s rockers, along with a whole host, Chuck Berry, Jerry Lee Lewis, etc., that planted the seeds of this devil music that's still going on, can't seem to stop it.
Gene's music and his image influenced so many of us in the 60s, and through our music, Gene Vincent lives. For John Lennon, the slapback echo and Gene's mean, quiff black leather look were part of his adolescence. Adam Seymour.
The influence that he had on John Lennon, right from the word go, from the Beatles, right up to John Lennon's last solo album, Just Like Starting Over, he's given it the full Gene treatment, and I haven't got long up in the time. It's, you know, he's still completely Gene Vincent.
It'll be just like starting over. Spencer Davis.
When you looked at Gene Vincent, you saw what influenced every Teddy Boy that came out of the UK. He was the inspiration. And if you look at some of the early haircuts that were sported by George Harrison, John Lennon, more Gene Vincent than Elvis Presley. But that presentation, which was a million miles from, say, Matt Munro. This was wild. And his use of the microphone probably influenced Rod Stewart, even Robert Plant. I mean, Robert Plant used to hurl the microphone around as well.
Jerry Lee Lewis.
He could take a game leg he had and sling it clean over the top of a microphone. I never seen anything like it. Wild as the West Texas wind. He give them a show.
The rockabilly crowd, of course, hails Gene as their hero. Lee Rocker of the Stray Cats.
Maybe this generation listening remembers the Sex Pistols. That's what Gene Vincent was at the time. Raw energy and passion and just this incredible feeling of breaking the mold of everything that came before it. Rockabilly music in general, and Gene Vincent in particular, that's the original punk rock. A hybrid, a blend of other things before it, of rhythm and blues and hillbilly music and their own thing thrown in there. The difference between punk music and rockabilly music is that you had like real players and singers doing it. It wasn't just abandon, you know, youthful abandon and energy. There was that, but there was a real background in musicianship.
He probably wasn't an easy man to love, but his sister Tina saw through to the tortured soul inside.
I would say he was the most unhappiest father, brother, son of any man or any woman I've ever known. He was a tortured soul, but he was beautiful. He could make you laugh so easy. And he could open his voice and he could sing and make you feel like, oh, you know, just for a minute, I'm there. He was amazing.
Your poor heart will be broken, and your nights will be blue. Please don't laugh at my teardrops, it can happen to you.
For me, Roger Daltrey, goodbye.
Oh, won't you were happy, just for holding my hand. And you told me that you loved me. I cannot understand how you could leave me so lonely and blue. Please don't laugh at my teardrops, it can happen to you. Poor teardrops will find you, just wait and see. Teardrops will find you.
I always wished Gene well, and I still wish him well. I hope he made it to heaven.
Race with the Devil, the Gene Vincent story, was produced by Neil Rosser, and the Hollywood correspondent was Barbara Paskin.
Please don't laugh at my teardrops, it can happen to you. Please don't laugh at my
lay back.